You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and Skip, skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Adams and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. My apologies there to Gil Scott-Heron, 1971. Of course, the revolution will not be televised. Hello and welcome to A Photographic Life. Back to the old format this week. Now, I was watching the Brits the other week. I did it so that you didn't have to, obviously. But I also did it because I was watching it with my 11-year-old daughter. What it started to make me think was that music, like photography, has gone through a revolution of democratization. Everyone can make music now. They can record a beat on their phone. They can use all forms of software to create music sounds, find a singer, run that singer through other software, make them sound however they want, and then they can put it out on YouTube, on social media platforms, and so on and so forth. In a sense, the music has been televised, but the revolution within the music has gone. Started to make me think there about photography also. It's never been easier to make photographic images with our digital cameras, with our phones, and it's never been easier to share those through social media, exactly the same thing as with the music. But what I started to realise, listening and watching the Brits, was how the industry, the music industry, was manipulating what we hear. It was very obviously putting forward what it wanted to be, the new icons, rather than those icons coming through from the underground in the way in which they used to do. Sure, there was always the pop industry, but there was always breakthrough acts as well that could kind of manipulate and break up that industry. And it was exactly the same in the photographic industry. People would come through and create new ways of seeing. Disruptors would come into the scene. I think in a way what it meant to me when I was watching it was that we need curators for music. We need people to bring things forward. We need voices to bring forward types of music that ordinarily the industry doesn't want us to hear. I immediately, of course, think of John Peel and my good friend and old school chum, John Kennedy, on X Radio. These are people who show us and play us and let us hear things that ordinarily go under the radar. When we're being controlled through algorithms on social media, what we're seeing photographically is what we've seen before. It's exactly the same as the Brits. We're being manipulated by unseen forces. Whereas what we should really be doing is looking at a whole variety of different work, particularly work we don't like and that we don't understand. Because through seeing that, we might just evolve our understanding. Our likes may change. So I suppose this week's episode is dedicated to the underdog, to the underground. I like the idea of curators, but I don't like the idea of curators, I should say, with an agenda. So what I'm talking about, what I'm calling for this week is a death to all of that manipulation. I said we were returning to the old school format for this week's episode, and we are. But also this year, I've been trying to bring different voices to the podcast. Not just the voice of the photographer, but people who are intrinsically involved with the medium and with the sharing historical research of the medium. The curator is a strange beast in a way. Quite often I've spoken to people who are curators who don't own cameras and have never taken a photograph, but they're passionately involved with the subject. And this week, I'm really pleased to welcome to the podcast somebody who is exactly that. And it's Deborah Dash Moore, who was born in New York City and is the former director of the Frankel Center for Judaic Studies. And as a Frederick G. L. Whetwell Professor of History and Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. Dashmore earned her bachelor's degree in history from Brandeis University and continued her education at Columbia University, receiving her MA in history in 1968 and her PhD in 1975. She taught for many years at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, and wrote and co-edited numerous books, articles, and collections. Her first book, At Home in America, Second Generation New York Jews, was published in 1981. And her second, To the Golden Cities, Pursuing the American Jewish Dream in Miami and L.A. in 1994. In 1997, her co-edited two-volume, Jewish Women in America, an Historical Encyclopedia, was published. In 2004, her book, G.I. Jews, How World War II Changed a Generation, was awarded the Washington Post Best Book of the Year. In 2008, she published American Jewish Identity Politics, a collection of essays, and in 2011, her book Gender and Jewish History was awarded a National Jewish Book Award. In 2012, NYU Press published a three-volume series edited by Moore, City of Promises, A History of the Jews of New York. In 2016, she was named Editor-in-Chief of the Posen Library of Jewish Culture and Civilization. And in 2023, her book, Walkers in the City, was published, which draws on the experiences of and photographs by a generation of young Jewish photographers who belong to the New York Photo League. That's one hell of a CV. So let's hear from Deborah, shall we?
What does photography mean to me? A historian of photography, but not a photographer myself. It means a chance to see the world through the eyes of others, as I do in my book, Walkers in the City, Jewish Street Photographers of Mid-Century New York. There are many ways of learning about the past, but especially the photographs of street photographers allow one literally to walk the streets together with women and men who developed a keen eye to picture the city. They were interested in what their neighbors and fellow New Yorkers were doing, and through their photographs, I get to understand the texture of daily life. Because of the way a photograph freezes a moment and gives us a license to stare, I can study these street photographs, noting their rich details that transport me back to the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. I also can discover how people looked at these photographers and, as a result, at me as I look at the photo. Photography reminds us of the importance of looking and of taking responsibility for what we see. In Walkers in the City, I organize the chapters thematically, according to how photographers themselves pictured people. The book begins with the theme of looking, which is fundamental to photography. In the city, everyone looks and is looked at in return. The Jewish street photographers took photos of people looking, occasionally even of people refusing to look. Another thing people do in the city is wait. And street photographers took photos of people waiting, capturing the gestures of waiting, whether standing up or sitting down. Then photography also shows me how things were different in the 1940s. Back then, people had conversations on the streets of the city, as photographs reveal. Then telephones became popular, and photographs depicted these one-sided conversations in phone booths. Today, the booths are gone, and all of that talking happens on personal devices. Photography can transport me. It is my means of time traveling. I love the trips that photography lets me take.
Thank you for your contribution this week, Deborah. I think it's interesting to me because I'm always saying how, for me, photography is memory made history. So always hear from, interesting, I should say, to hear from a different perspective. It does seem to me that you're enjoying listening to all of these different perspectives, the interview stroke conversations, really. They're not really interviews because nothing's ever planned that I'm doing, that's for sure, that we've been having over the last few weeks. And thanks very much for letting us know about that. A couple of comments I thought I'd share with you. One, an email from listener John Kenny saying, I've just listened to the episode with Bob Tursack. A really good one if you haven't listened to that one a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, said he's listened to it twice. I commented on the post in Threads, and you quite rightly said that this would be a useful one. I remember you mentioning a book written by a model that you said would be useful for photographers who work in that environment to read. It's actually a book written by Twiggy. John, there you go for that. The reversed perspective, providing valuable insight on the process. I was wondering if there were books on printing that might prove similarly valuable, or whether it is something that has to be experienced in person. Not sure about that, John. I'll check in with Bob. It would be fair to say that I could listen to Bob talk about his work for a lot longer, especially around the connection between the work, the photographer, and the printer. I hope that there are plenty of people around him that are trying to absorb those skills and passion. Thank you to Bob and yourself once again for such an engaging episode. Another little comment here. From Paul Morgan. He says, interesting comments on the role stroke position of podcast in the recent episode featuring Bill Shapiro and myself when we were talking about editorial photography. Paul says, as it turns out, I downloaded the latest iPhone update this morning, which transcribes your podcast. So you've now become the written long form conversation too. And that's fascinating. I'm not an iPhone user myself. I do occasionally use Otter AI, but that idea of the spoken word becoming the written word becoming the spoken word, and the visual narrative becoming the audio narrative, I think for me are all really interesting areas for photographers to think about. Whilst we're talking about the interactive nature of this particular podcast, apologies for that little cough there, but this has been the first day in over a week that I haven't been channeling the deep walrus of love, Barry White, in my speech. And this is about as good as I've sounded for a while, but my throat is still somewhat dry. You're probably hearing that it's also very echoey in the shed now, as everything has been moved out, ready for our move into the new studio. But anyway, it's not stopping me from producing this weekly podcast, of course, keeping my eye open for little kind of comments and little tidbits, really, that I thought it's kind of interesting to share with you. I saw one by the great singer, songwriter, bon vivant, character and actor, Tom Waits. We were hearing from Gil Scott-Heron at the beginning of this episode, and now we're moving on to Tom Waits. He said this. Jim Jarmusch, of course, the great film director who Tom Waits worked with, once told me, fast, cheap and good. Pick two. If it's fast and cheap, it won't be good. If it's cheap and good, it won't be fast. If it's fast and good, it won't be cheap. Fast, cheap and good. Pick two words to live by. Typically, Tom Waits, I should imagine. I'd love to hear his particular presentation of those words, a bit like Gil Scott-Heron's, really. I'm not doing them any favours here by just reading them. There was a fantastic podcast on BBC Radio 6 a few months ago where Iggy Pop and Tom Waits spent a couple of hours choosing their favourite music. I really recommend checking that out. But anyway, we digress and we go off at a tangent there, as I so often do. But the whole conversation, again, about photography and buying expensive equipment, I think is totally responded to that. I saw another comment the other day about the idea of you can get a good picture from a cheap camera and you can get a good picture from an expensive camera. And we know all of this. You know, this is old and it's boring really to keep going over it. But the comment that was being made was that the expensive camera has a feel to it and it feels better in the hand, and therefore the actual process is so much richer than working with a cheap camera. Now, I suppose in a way that's what Jarmusch is kind of insinuating there. I'm not sure I could choose two words to live by between fast, cheap and good. I definitely go with the good. I suppose sometimes I'm to do with the fast. I'm not somebody who likes to spend a lot of time thinking about things. I mean, as you know, this podcast is not planned in any way. It's very, very freeform with no script of any kind whatsoever. But that idea that we have to spend money to make the process feel better does sit rather awkwardly with me, because surely what we should be talking about is the outcome, the finished artifact, and not becoming obsessed with the idea of the process itself from that sort of selfish perspective of the photographer. And that made me think, is it the case that actually buying expensive equipment and constantly buying new equipment is very much about the photographer's selfish needs rather than the outcome itself? I'll leave you to think about that. But it also did occur to me that in the last week I've bought a new television. It's the first television I've purchased in 15 years. I'm not a big new adopter of anything, or first adopter. Now, suddenly, we have a huge HD 4K television in the house. We only have one television in the house. We're not one of those people that have one in every room. But what it has already made me realise was how I was missing out on so much creativity in the cinematography in the few films I've had time to watch, whereas previously on my old television, all of that kind of nuance, particularly being made in films at the moment, those long films, those 2-3 hour long films, I've been missing out on that. So am I arguing against myself here? I don't know. But what I do know is that I'd like to hear from you and let me know what you think. Just finally this week, I don't think any of us can not be aware of the intensely political world in which we're now living. It doesn't matter whether or not it's national, international politics, local politics, regional politics. It does seem to be that we're becoming increasingly divided into a them and us situation. And photography seems to be leading the way in showing us the realities. I think in that case, we have to be really careful that we don't fall into the trap of becoming a team member. That as photographers, we need to keep our eyes open, but we also need to keep our minds open. We need to be willing to listen. Listen to those we don't agree with, as well as those who we do agree with. I think that's increasingly important for photographers. And as part of that kind of thought process, we're going to be talking about politics and photography in future episodes. Because I think that 2024 could actually be one of the most important years we've had in history for photography and for politics. Only time will tell if I am right. But I know for one thing, I'm going to take care. And I really hope that you do too.